Welcome everyone to True Crime Talkers San Diego, episode number 4. As always, I'm your host Jamie, and I've got a really interesting case for you all today. Now I know last episode I teased that we would be going over the Danielle Van Dam case. However, I do have to apologize because sadly I am going to be postponing that case just for now. But don't worry, it will be coming soon. I've actually been working on this case for a couple weeks, and the reason why I'm postponing it is because I'm trying to arrange interviews. So please bear with me on that one. It does take a little time to, you know, hear back from people, conduct the interview, all that jazz. But I am trying something new. I'm very excited for it. I haven't interviewed anyone on this podcast yet, so that's going to be really cool. So sorry again for the delay on that one. And maybe hyping you up for it. But I do just want to make these episodes as good as I can. And I think an interview will really help with that episode, because there is kind of a lot of controversy and mystery, and lots of people have different theories about who did it and what happened. So I have a question of my own that would make things more clear in my mind. And it takes someone that knows the house and the family. So I'm hoping I can interview someone who does. And it's in the works. So anyways, look forward to that. But in the meantime, I do have a good case today. This case was actually requested by a viewer. So that's very exciting. It's a really good one. It's an event that involves the police. And it made San Diegans second guess their public safety still to this day. So, very interesting indeed. Thank you so much, Ryan, for requesting this case. It is definitely a good one. But before we jump into that one, let's start off this episode, as always, with our current news story. Steve Turay was last seen on January 26, 2021, at the All Seasons RV Park. He's a 55-year-old man who is known to suffer from health issues. He was reported missing January 27th, which makes him a high-risk case for the police since he requires medicine. He was staying at the All Seasons RV Park off Highway 395 and was last reported seen on the 26th around 11 p.m. walking away from the RV park. More than 65 search and rescue volunteers, including personnel with trained tracking dogs, spent 2 days searching the RV park and campground. The search also included a sheriff's helicopter, a drone, and reserve deputies diving in the campground's lake. By Friday, after the initial 2-day search, sheriff's officials scaled back their efforts, and a minimal search was still conducted. This Tuesday, a tracking dog zeroed in on an area of the RV park's lake, where divers, sadly, find Turay's body. It's unclear if there was any foul play and what exactly happened, but the county medical examiner's office will determine the cause and manner of his death soon. So very mysterious. I just don't know what would have happened to Steve. It's definitely a head scratcher. My heart does go out to the Turay family, and I really do hope you guys get some answers soon. The year is 1986, and it's winter in San Diego. Kara Knott is a 20-year-old at this time, and she is very beautiful. She's very much like your typical Cali girl with blonde hair, bright eyes, and a contagious smile. She's a junior at SDSU and is studying to become a teacher. She comes from a very loving family, and she's the third of 4 siblings. Her mother describes her as being bubbly and tender-hearted, an artist, an animal lover, and someone who always has time for everybody. She was also a track star, an environmentalist, and worked at the zoo. Overall, she just seems to be a very sweet girl and definitely a model citizen. Kara also had a very handsome boyfriend named Wayne. The two of them were such a beautiful couple, definitely head turners wherever they went, and you could just tell that they really do love each other very, very much. Her life seems virtually perfect, right? She's got so much going for her, and she has her whole life ahead of her. Well, sadly, we are talking about her on a true crime podcast, so things unfortunately take a turn for the worst. Her boyfriend Wayne comes down with the flu, so Kara drives to his home in Escondido to give him a visit. Her mother, Joyce, not even chuckles as Kara would call her a couple times asking about nursing questions as she tried to care for Wayne and his condition. By 8 p.m., Kara calls her father, Sam Knott, to let him know that she's leaving Wayne's and is going to be heading back home to El Cajon. Time goes by, and Kara still hadn't returned home. Her father just couldn't shake this feeling of dread and had this gut feeling that Kara was in some sort of trouble. So her family snaps into action and begins to search for her. They call the police to report her missing, and they check with local hospitals to see if anybody knew anything. But unfortunately, there was no luck. The next morning, her brother-in-law spots her 1968 white Volkswagen Beetle by a bridge just below the I-15 at Mercy Road. The driver's window was half open, the keys were still in the ignition, and her purse was on the seat. It appeared to be that the car was abandoned. The police arrive and happen to know this area very well. Under the 15 is a dead-end, dark, and desolate area, a place where police were known to go to write up reports. However, they did not stick around too long because it definitely had this eerie feeling to it, and the police would often refer to this area as the tombs, due to the way it looks from underneath the roadway. The police search the area, and unfortunately, they find a body, dumped from the bridge about 70 feet below. Her father, Sam Knott, is there during the search, and asks the police if they found her. They regrettably say yes and inform him that she's dead. Sam is so sweet in his response to the officers, and he immediately says, quote, "I wish you would have known her. She was an angel." Now that quote really stood out to the police officer, and it is quite interesting because when I read it, I could just feel both the pride that he has for his daughter, but also the sorrow of his loss. The police document the crime scene and take her body for an autopsy. In the report, there were no signs of sexual assault, but she did have ligature marks on her neck and a bruise on her face. It is then determined that she died of strangulation and was then thrown from the bridge. The only other clues from the crime scene was a receipt found in her car from the Chevron gas station, and a set of tire marks. The police hypothesized that she had filled up for gas and left the station alone, but whoever it was that led her off the freeway was someone that she knew and trusted because she definitely went willingly. So naturally, the police immediately start to suspect her boyfriend. You know, that's usually the first suspect that they always look at is the husband or the boyfriend or something like that. But thankfully, Wayne's sister corroborates his alibi of being homesick at the time. Kara didn't seem to have any enemies, so it seemed unlikely that someone would be out to kill her. So then the police start to think maybe she was just a victim of opportunity for someone. Now, just like the crime scene, the police begin to find themselves at a dead end. The news eventually breaks about her death, and the entire community is just completely shocked. Police ask a local TV station to feature Kara's story on their Crime Stoppers program in hopes that maybe someone would know something and it would help, you know, generate some clues. So the producers do their best to reenact her last few hours. They had a white VW bug, a blonde girl at the gas station filling up, and everything. And they got a couple calls regarding the show, you know, witnesses that had seen her at the gas station, stuff like that, but no really promising leads. 2 days after her death, a local news reporter, Rory Devine, partners up with Highway Patrolman Craig Pyre for a segment on driver safety. This was definitely at the forefront of everyone's minds. They were really freaked out from her case, and, you know, driver safety was like a hot topic right then. Rory says that Craig would tell the viewers, quote, "If somebody should come up to your car and offer help, just ask them to call the CHP, which is the California Highway Patrol. Don't get out of your car and walk up the freeway, because once you get in the car with someone, you are at their mercy." What's really interesting about this segment is that Craig is seen to have scratches on his face, and many viewers did take note of this. The case really starts to take off when 300 calls come in right after the show aired with Rory and Craig. Now, 30 women called saying that they recognized the 38-year-old Craig Pyer. Now, this is the really juicy part, because all of these women reported that they had been pulled over by Craig near Mercy Road. They were instructed by Craig to drive to the same area where Kara's body was found. They said that he wasn't violent with them, but that he definitely gave them all the creeps. He would sit in the passenger seats and ask really personal questions, request dates, and even sometimes he would stroke their hair or shoulders. Ugh. He also would detain some of the women for really just unnecessary amounts of time. Some said up to an hour. And if you aren't creeped out enough by all of that, it actually gets weirder because all 30 women are blonde, young, and look very similar to Kara. So he definitely did have a type. And it was becoming apparent to SDPD that he had a reputation for following young drivers, pulling them over on the pretext of a citation or a ticket, and then became overly friendly with them. Now, this was very eye-opening to the SDPD because they considered Craig to be one of their finest men. He'd been in the force for 13 years, he had a clean record, he wrote a lot of tickets, answered his radio at the first call, and he was someone that you could always count on. His whole life was being a California Highway Patrolman. That was his entire identity to him. One of Craig's ex-wives even says that he became like Mr. Macho after joining the CHP, and that he used his badge to flirt with women. You know, he's so hottie-totty. Other friends and coworkers also noticed how he would become very confident once he was in his uniform and described him as being very cocky. Which, you know, doesn't surprise me that he liked being on TV in his uniform, you know, looking all superior and whatnot, flaunting it for the ladies. Yeah. You know, being put in a power of authority really does have an effect on a person psychologically. Which is why I'm a very strong believer that the police positions need to be taken more seriously when it comes to hiring and recruiting people. I think the police nationwide need to be more educated. They should meet certain scores and personality tests and psychological tests, and just overall need to vet their officers more thoroughly, because otherwise people like Craig and thousands of other examples are able to slip through the cracks. Not everyone can handle having a badge and resist abusing the power of that badge. But getting back to the story here, things were definitely not looking good for Craig. People were becoming very suspicious of him, and an investigation was soon conducted. Now, Craig reports that he has an alibi, which can be seen in his report book. His book said that he was miles away giving a traffic ticket around 9:30 p.m., which is the approximate time when they think that Kara was killed. Now, when investigators were questioning Craig, they definitely took note of the scratches on his face and trauma to his arm. It definitely looked like he had been in a scuffle or a fight. But Craig was prepared and explains it away, saying that he fell on the fence in the police barracks that same night. However, this is not likely, because a fellow officer describes that the fences there were very tall and they were a bit, you know, a distance back from where Craig's police car would have been. So he would have had to take a running leap in order to hit his face on a fence. Seems a bit unlikely, huh? The best witness, though, was an off-duty cop at the time, and he noticed a disheveled and scratched-up Pyer drive in at high speeds that same night. He disputes Craig's unconvincing claim about the fence by saying that he noted Craig's injuries a full hour before Pyer even claimed to have gotten them. Investigators then take a second look at his little logbook, and they notice that at the time of 9:30, there was something that was erased. You know how erasers usually have like that smudged look? Well, that's what was there at 9:30. So did Craig attempt to cover up his tracks and create a false alibi? Reporter Rory Devine was surprised to see that he had become suspect number one and says, quote, "He had done stories with the media for years, and he seemed so concerned, and he seemed so upset about the fact that this young woman had been killed. So Craig obviously denies any involvement with Kara and willingly turns over his uniform from that night so that they can inspect it. Now, on his uniform, there's a gold edge patch that they all wear on their shoulders. It's like the main patch, I think, that says like protect and serve, stuff like that. And criminologist John Simmons analyzes this patch very closely. Something just seemed very familiar to him about this gold color, because he actually remembered seeing a gold strand similar to this one on Kara's sweatshirt. The gold fiber is further analyzed with microscopes and a lot of science stuff that I don't fully understand. But the end results show conclusively that these fibers from her clothes are the same as the one from the badge. Aha! Now there was a concrete link between Kara and Officer Pyre. A purple fiber was also found on his boots and gun, which were analyzed in the same way as the gold fiber, and they were an exact match to her purple sweatpants. So now the police seem to have the who, but the how and the why are still a mystery to them. So the police continue their search, and they look at the patrol car. They pay special attention to the trunk, you know, thinking that maybe he put her in there, there would be DNA evidence of her, something like that. Unfortunately, they did not find any of her DNA in his car. So that was kind of a bust, but not to worry, because they actually did find something very remarkable in the trunk. Under the spare tire was a small piece of yellow rope. Could this be a piece to the murder weapon? Because remember, she died of strangulation, and a rope is a pretty common thing to strangle someone with, so This new finding gave the police an idea. They compared the rope piece that they found to the ligature marks on her neck, and they find yet another match. On Kara's shoes, there was also a tiny drop of blood found. Sadly, by this time in the 80s, the SDPD was not using DNA analysis yet, but they did look at blood type. And it turned out that the blood was AB negative, which just so happens to be the most rare type of blood. Only 1% of the population has it. And can you guess who else has AB negative blood type? Craig, of course. Coincidence? I think not. The last few pieces of evidence against Craig were those tire marks on the road. The police matched those tires with that of his police cruiser, and bingo, they were a match. Another thing was the bruise found on Kara's face was the exact same size as that of a police flashlight. So again, we definitely have the who. We have most of the how, but the why is still lacking. What would make Craig want to kill Kara? He's never had a violent past and record in all of his years in the police force, so what was it about her that made him snap? Is this starting to sound like a round of Clue to anyone else? With the who and the how and the murder weapons, the rope and all of this? Alright, now let's get serious here. Let me set the scene for you guys according to what the police believe may have happened. So Kara leaves her boyfriend's place and gets into her car and heads home. She's driving along when suddenly she gets a low fuel light. She pulls over and fills up at a nearby Chevron. Meanwhile, Craig is patrolling in his cruiser. He notices the beautiful blonde at the gas station and decides to follow her onto the 15. Once they get close to his favorite interrogation spot, he turns on his lights and over the speaker instructs her to follow him down to the next exit. Once there, she rolls down her window and he, you know, gives a BS excuse for pulling her over. Perhaps he tries to put on the charm and attempts to get into her car like he has with other women. Now this probably makes Kara uncomfortable and threatens to report his behavior. This angers Craig and he orders her to exit the vehicle for further questioning. Things may have gotten physical by this point, and Kara fights back, scratching his face. He then knocks her unconscious with a blow to her head with the flashlight, and Kara slumps down to the ground. Craig now sees that he's gone way too far. He can't leave her here because she's seen his face and will most likely report him, just like she threatened. He's in way too deep and decides that it's best to silence her forever. That's when he decides to grab the rope from his trunk and strangle the poor girl to death. He then puts her limp body on the hood of his car so as not to get DNA inside the vehicle and slowly drives to the nearby bridge. He disposes of her body by throwing her over the side and down to the brush below and flees the scene. It's pretty ironic that the golden fiber from his CHP patch, which was a symbol that was just so important to him and represented his oath to protect and serve, would eventually be his undoing. On January 15th, 1987, Craig Pyre was arrested and charged with the murder of Kara Knott, and in May, he was officially fired from the CHP. On January 15th, 1987, Craig Pyre was arrested and charged with the murder of Kara Knott, and in May, he was officially fired from the CHP. Now, still to this day, Craig claims his innocence. But before I tell you the results of his trial, I just want to go over the list of evidence real quick so that you guys can make your own decision on his guilt or innocence. Because remember, what I just narrated to you guys is only the scenario of what the police believe happened. The only two people that really know what happened and how it all went down is Craig and Kara. So here's all the evidence that we have against Craig. 30 allegations from women that he's encountered on duty reporting his strange behavior and having a type for young blonde women. His wife and co-workers describe his personality as being very cocky when in uniform. The gold fiber found on Kara's body. Purple fibers found on his uniform from her pants. Blood found on her shoes matching his specific rare blood type. Rope from his trunk that matched the bruises that she has on her neck. The bruise on her head is the same size as the police flashlight. The tire marks were a match. The erase marks and the exact time of the murder in his log entry. And last but not least, Craig showed injuries that one could have gotten from a struggle. So what do you guys think? Guilty or not guilty? Make your predictions now. You got them? Okay. Now I'm going to go over what resulted from his two trials. So the first trial was the State of California versus Craig Pyre, which was in February of 1988, and it resulted in a hung jury of 7-5 for conviction. And Pyre did not end up testifying. In the second trial, Craig's third wife, Karen, testifies about that night. She explains how he came home on the night of December 27th, 1986 at 11 p.m. He did have fresh scratches on his face, but that they weren't dripping any blood. She never asked where he got them and insists that he didn't show any unusual emotions that day. He was just very tired. And again, Craig does not testify in his second trial either. However, this jury did not deadlock. They find him guilty of first-degree murder. Now, this was very big news because it was the first time ever that an on-duty CHP officer was convicted of murder. The judge, Richard Hoffman, who ruled over both trials, compliments the CHP for working so hard to investigate one of their own and restore their damaged reputation from the public. However, he does also slap them on the wrist by saying the CHP also holds some blame for her murder, because they failed to act when a complaint about his behavior came in a month before the murder. He explains, quote, "I can't fix anything, I can only punish." Craig Pyre is sentenced to 25 years to life and has never admitted to killing Kara. Like I said earlier, he still claims to be innocent. Now, something very interesting happens in 2004. Because unlike the 80s, the police were now using DNA to help solve cases. As part of a wrongful conviction project, authorities from the district attorney office asked Craig if he wants them to test the DNA with that of the DNA evidence from his case. He declines. Crazy, right? If you really were innocent, wouldn't you want to do everything in your power to clear your name? Now, Craig is obviously not the only person to refuse giving DNA in order to clear their name, but it's just mind-blowing how many people want to claim their innocence, but yet won't pony up to dispute any evidence against them. It just makes no sense, unless you're guilty. If you committed a crime and get caught, and especially if you're currently serving that sentence, just give up the facade and own up to your mistakes. Like, I just don't know why he wouldn't. Like, it's such a bad look. I actually felt a little, just a teeny tiny bit sorry for the guy. My first impression of him when researching was that, you know, he was just a guy with major insecurity problems that creeped on women. And, you know, no offense, but that description can fit a lot of people. But, you know, he did have a clean record before this crime. He had a long track record of working with the media in regards to crime prevention and seemed to really have, like, a passion for his job. Overall, he just came across as being a creepy guy who got in way over his head. But please don't get me wrong. I'm not making any excuses for his actions. I think what Craig did to Kara is absolutely disgusting, and I definitely think that he needs to pay for his terrible crimes, and I'm glad that he's in jail. But in regards to his continued claim of innocence, just any shred of sympathy that I had for him completely was destroyed by then. I'm just like, I have no respect for this guy. He's not fooling anyone by playing these games. And you know, it just all comes back to his cockiness. Because I truly believe that he literally thought that he could get away with murder by lying and hiding behind his badge's authority. It's so sad and disgusting. 2004 was a very busy year for Craig. He also had his first parole hearing that year. He obviously was denied parole due to his lack of remorse, as well as his refusal to explain why he was innocent and yet not allow any testing to prove his innocence. Which, I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you can't prove it and you're not even willing, then you might as well just say you're guilty at that point, because you're not fooling anyone. So good on the parole board for denying him. And 2008 rolls around, denied again. They were also frustrated at him, you know, saying he's innocent and all this BS. So by 2012, he was denied for the third time, and they decided that he wouldn't be eligible for parole again until 2027, because 15 years is the longest time frame that you can go, you know, setting a parole hearing. So they were fed up too. I don't blame them. Today, Craig is in his late 60s and remains in custody at the California Men's Colony, a state prison in San Luis Obispo. However, controversy did arise in 2020 due to certain felons being released to stop the spread of COVID-19 in prison. Kara's family were obviously very worried that Craig may be released, and they wrote a letter to the governor. Kara's sister writes, quote, "This is precisely not a person who deserves to be released early from prison for humanitarian reasons. Officer Pyre showed no mercy when he murdered my sister." Thankfully, the CDCR says that at this time, there are no plans to expedite the release of Craig Pyre. Now, what Craig did was, you know, obviously horrible. And it really did have a long-lasting impact that is still felt to this day. Ever since that case in the late 80s, women began to fear being pulled over by the police, especially if they were in the car alone during the night. Prosecutor Finks, who worked for Kara's family, says, quote, "I have never seen a case that has such a direct impact on the people's perception of their safety, especially women. It popped the bubble of perceived safety." Now, thankfully, you know, because of this case, the police have made some changes in this area. They now allow solo drivers to maintain driving until they've reached a populated or safe area to be pulled over. But the fear that Craig caused in the community is still felt to this day. I thankfully have never been pulled over before, but my mom has definitely drilled into my head that if I am being pulled over, especially at night, you know, when it's dark and you can't exactly see the police car behind you, all you see is the lights, that you should call 911, which to some of you may sound a bit weird, especially to, you know, male listeners. Like, why would you call 911? You're just being pulled over. But just hang in there with me because this is going to be today's safety tip, and it's really good for both men and women. So the reason why you would call 911 is to make sure that the officer flashing you is actually an active duty policeman. The 911 operator can give you a confirmation, yes or no, if a police officer is indeed in that area, which is super important for two reasons. Number one, you're recorded being pulled over, so if a policeman is acting suspicious or being inappropriate with you, then this makes his or her denial or confusion of the situation irrelevant, because it puts a definite link between the two of you if anything were to go bad or something happened during that particular time frame. And number two, it's very important to confirm that the car behind you is a legit officer. Because there's so many awful, awful stories of imposters abducting people under the false pretense of being an officer. They abuse the trust and authority and security that people have with law enforcement, and they weaponize that. And that's sort of what Craig did. Now, of course, I'm not saying to, you know, mistrust the police. Most are actually upholding their oath to protect and serve. But what I am saying is that it's never wrong to be cautious and to have your bases covered. Because sadly, crimes and arrests of SDPD officers still occur to this day. You know, there's always bad apples that slip through the cracks. It is unfortunate that this happens, and you know, when these recent incidents of police crimes occur, Kara's family is rightfully frustrated by all that. They say how it outrages them and sickens them that it still happens. Her sister even says, quote, "It makes me relive my sister Kara's murder all over again." Just, I can't imagine. And listen to this. This is from Kara's mother, Joyce Knott. She writes 10 News and says, quote, "I just don't want our family to appear that we are against the police. We have the utmost respect for the department and the majority of the officers. It just seems that after all of these years, there should be a better way to identify the bad ones. Thank goodness times have changed, and at least some of the women who are harassed or taken advantage of do come forward and report these incidents. When there is a pattern of behavior of controlling women through sexual advances, there is the chance that the actions may escalate and another person's life might be in danger. I want to encourage any woman who finds herself in such a situation to speak up and report it. By doing so, she may save the life of another innocent woman. It would have saved Kara's." I fully agree with everything that Joyce said, and I think that it's a really important message from such an outstanding and strong family. And it's not just the mom and sister, like the whole family is so great and strong. After his daughter's death, Sam Knott became an advocate for crime victims, campaigning tirelessly for law enforcement agencies to construct a new way to monitor the locations and activities of their officers at all times. He also pressed for agencies to erase the standard 48-hour waiting time before issuing a missing person bulletin to officers in the field. And if that's not enough, he also established the Kara Knott Memorial Oak Garden, now called the San Diego Crime Victims Oak Garden, which is located in the Los Penasquitos Canyon Preserve where his daughter's body was found. It's so touching how he and his family turned this once eerie and isolated area where this horrible tragedy took place into this beautiful garden. And it's so heartwarming that they dedicated this space to his beautiful daughter as well as other victims of violent crimes. They spruced up this once dark area by planting rows of oak trees and other beautiful plants and flowers in remembrance of all the victims. Rocks circle the trees and they're dedicated to all the victims, and it's a place where family members and friends can leave pictures and flowers and mementos of their loved ones. There's also painted rocks with sweet messages and full of beautiful colors. And when you walk around the area, you can just see how much all of these people were truly loved. It's similar to a graveyard, but it's much, much more beautiful because instead of headstones, you have these gorgeous trees. And I don't know, I think the symbolism is just beautiful. Now, if you remember from earlier in the story, Kara's father just had this gut feeling that something was wrong and Kara was not okay. And he was also there when her body was found, and I just feel like he was the type of father that was always there. And he truly was always there. He would constantly go to the garden to tend it and pay his respects to his daughter. Sadly, in 2000, Sam was in the garden, as he usually was, when he suddenly passed away from a heart attack, just feet away from where Kara had died. It was very evident that although Sam was such a strong individual, he never fully recovered from losing Kara and literally died from a broken heart. Now, this is just a personal thought that I find really comforting, so I thought I would share it. I suppose it does, you know, rely on what your religious beliefs are. I'm not super religious myself, but I do believe in afterlife and heaven and all of that, and I believe that your loved ones are there to greet you when you cross over. So I just picture Sam being near Kara's tree, tending the garden, probably talking to her in his own way when he passes from that heart attack. And I just think it's so beautiful that he dies basically right next to her. You know, even though she's gone, he's still with her to the very last breath. And I just picture that Kara's there to welcome him to the afterlife. And you know, they're there together. And I just think it's so beautiful that, you know, he was there for her and did so much for not only her, but every victim out there. And now she can be there for him and help him cross over. And I don't know. I just think that's really beautiful. Sam just really seemed to be such a great person, just like Kara. The whole family just seems like really sweet people. There's a bench near where Kara's tree was that's dedicated to Sam, which I'm sure he probably just loves that. The Knott family truly just showered this once dark space with light and love, and I think that's just outstandingly beautiful and profound in so many ways. So thank you to the Knott family for taking this horrible event and tragic loss of yours and making the city of San Diego a better place. My hat goes off to them, and I have the utmost respect for everything that they've done. You know, cases like these are so important to talk about, and it's just a great example of how our city can come together, heal, and make change happen. The fight for change is definitely not over yet, but I know that we're heading in the right direction, and I find a lot of hope in that. Sorry for getting a little emotional there. I just think this case, although it was really sad and tragic, has such a beautiful and meaningful ending, and I think it's great. The Knott Memorial Bridge is on Interstate 15 by Mercy Road, and I know that I will always remember how great Kara was when I drive near the exit. And although this case is very sad because we lost Kara and she was such an amazing person, it's also so beautiful to see how her family and friends reacted to her loss. I think anybody would want that if something tragic was to happen. And I can't imagine how proud Kara must be. So on that happy note, that's all I have for you guys this time. Thank you so much for suggesting this case. I'm always taking requests and suggestions if you have a particular case that you want me to cover. Feel free to reach out to me. I hope you guys liked this episode. If you did, don't forget to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. The link's going to be in the show notes, and I would really, really appreciate it. It really does help out the podcast. I put a lot of work into these episodes, and any positive review that I get just really puts a fire under my booty to keep it up. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. Stay tuned for next week because Valentine's Day is just around the corner. And next time we're going to be talking about some Valentine's Day killings. So thanks again for listening. This has been True Crime Talker San Diego. And until next time, stay safe.